Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, in a new film, Sword of Trust, a pawn shop owner, played by Marc Maron, gets a hold of a Civil War relic that is a prover, an item that can prove that the South actually won the Civil War.
You are correct. This is a Union sword. This was given to my great-great-great-great-grandpappy, who was a field marshal in the Confederate Army.
Yeah.
And this was surrendered to him by General Sheridan.
It was surrendered to him by a Union general.
Mm-hmm.
What battle are we talking about here?
This battle? Oh, it's Chickamauga.
Chickamauga. I don't think that battle.
Not familiar with it?
I don't think it happened.
Well, it happened.
Okay.
I assure you, 30,000 men lost their lives that day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You probably haven't heard of it because it's buried.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in history books.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what do you mean buried?
It is buried from the history books.
Yeah.
By deep state.
Okay.
Because of
she's
deep
saying
state.
It's
deep state.
Deep state. Yeah.
Shadow government.
Oh, that was the original name, shadow government.
Okay, what you were looking at?
Yes.
Is a genuine relic. A very valuable piece of evidence that supports the actual truth, which is the South won the war.
Okay. The South won the war?
That's right.
Show them the documentation.
Here.
Have you told anybody else this?
This is something you want to keep under your hat till you're ready to
seems
not
like
keep
pretty
it
big
under your
news.
Head.
The comedy follows Mel and his cohorts as they arrange to sell the item to Confederate sympathizers. I guess that's the best way to put it. For thousands of dollars. It's a film that unwittingly puts the pawn shop owner in the middle of the unseemly world of white power, all for a big payout. The film, written and directed by Lynn Shelton, has a great cast, including former Chicagoans like Dan Bacadal and Mike O'Brien, who co-wrote on the script. But the star, the man who makes the film work, is Marc Maron. The movie is just the latest in Maron's impressive acting career. The stand-up comedian can be seen in great TV like Glow on Netflix, season 3 coming out in August, and Joe Swanberg's Easy, and in films like the upcoming Joker, which will be out this fall. And of course, Maron continues with WTF, maybe the most influential podcast in podcast history. Like I said, Sword of Trust is in theaters now. Marc Maron, my guest on Extension 720. Marc, thanks for being here.
Sure, man. Thanks for having me. Now, the way you described that movie, it didn't necessarily sound like a comedy. So I want to be clear. Sounded like a deep dive into some horrible stuff. And it's a relatively deep dive into some seemingly horrible stuff, but it's a comedy caper that kind of, you know, gets into the space and into the South and into the heads of, you know, conspiracy driven people. And even the way you described the conspiracy that the movie revolves around, it almost sounded like it was a real one.
Well, and there's something to be said about that. That's a very hard topic to make funny, but you guys do a good job of it.
Well, the thing is that it's a sad state of affairs when the idea that there are a group of people that, yeah, it's one thing to believe in the Confederacy. It's another thing to believe that the South won the war, and that's somehow been hidden from history.
Right.
But because of the culture we live in, yeah, I'm sure that some people are like, yeah, that's probably a real one. That's probably a real conspiracy. That makes sense that those people would believe that.
When you think about that area, because it's funny, because we'll do like antique kind of roadshow type stuff on the show. We do a show called Swap Meet where people call up with their items, but they all stay away from that kind of stuff, whether it be Nazi relics from World War II or Confederate relics. For whatever reason, that's a hotbed of, because it's based in racism and all sorts of dark stuff. So it is interesting, as a pawn shop owner in this film, you kind of have the same thought, reservations about getting involved with this because of the people who want to buy this stuff.
I guess so, but do I? I mean, I think that initially my response was that this is ridiculous that people could want this and that people believe in this. But when I saw that you could get some money for it,
right.
Not that it was what was driving me, but I think there was a mixture of fascination with the mindset. Yeah, I certainly have judgment of those people in the film and the idea that there's money involved. Kind of was curious to me, and my life is sort of stagnated in the movie, and I'm sort of a relatively, you know, broken-hearted dude that's been through a lot, and I'm kind of resigned to my place in the world. But I think I was like looking for something to give my life a little purpose and to kind of push the envelope a little bit, get out there on the edge. But yeah, there's there's judgment there, but it's weird because when I was growing up, Nazi paraphernalia mm-hmm. and all that stuff, there was a guy, I grew up in New Mexico in Albuquerque, there was a doctor, a Jewish doctor that used to have a booth at the flea market and he sold Nazi paraphernalia. So I guess, of course, it's loaded. It's always been loaded. And the fact that I don't know if it's great to necessarily live in a culture where, you know, the artifacts themselves have to be somehow, you know, subject to historical revisionism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, they are what they are. They're fascinating. They're dark. They're horrible. But, you know, those knives were kind of cool.
Well, the great part about the film is that the stories fall apart. The, you know, whatever the backstory of the paraphernalia, in this case, the sword.
As is true with most conspiracy theories, right. If the people bother to research them. You know, if things make too much sense, especially when there's parts of them that are completely ridiculous, just because you get emotional closure out of knowing the story, it has no bearing on the truth of the story. And just because you believe it doesn't make it any more true. But it seems that we live in a world where if enough people believe something, there's a momentum there that is usually used to dubious ends.
What drew you to the script? I mean, it's Lynn Shelton. You've worked with her for a while now. But what drew you to doing this film and playing the character Mel?
Well, Lynn and I have worked together a lot, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for her work. You know, she's done about 8 films, and she did a couple episodes of my show, Marin, on IFC, and I met her when we did my podcast. And then, coincidentally, she directed some GLOW episodes. She does a lot of TV work as well. And she directed my last comedy special. We began to write a script together that we've sort of been working on and off for, you know, almost 3 years, and we weren't quite getting it done. And she just really wanted to make a movie with me. So I said, well, you know, you could just, writing for me is a very tedious process. And she was getting a little impatient.
Why is it a tedious process to write for you?
Because it's horrendous. I mean, you just sit there by yourself or with somebody else and try to pull something out of the air. I mean, writing, like, I write a thing every week for my listeners, and, you know, my comedy, most of my stand-up is developed on stage in real time. I kind of create improvisationally. I work through ideas in front of people until they kind of hone themselves into the pieces that I do on stage. Sometimes I improvise the roots of things that become comedy pieces in the opening monologues of my podcast. But Lynn has, like, always been a big believer in my talent, and we, over time, have grown to work well together. Yeah, I was resistant initially. I'm resistant to most direction, but I'm growing as a person, and I realized that my first reaction doesn't have to be like, nah, I don't think so. So, no, I'm not doing that. Why would I do that?
It's really hard just knowing your work and everyone getting to know you as an actor, not just a comedian, but this role is you. And to the point where even some of the things, the pawn shop owner Mel, he likes guitars. He grew up in New Mexico. He's from New Mexico.
Right.
Has a background with drugs. It seems, how much are you able to bring your own personal storylines, parallels to the character as backstory?
The answer to the last question is really that, you know, Lynn, when I told her, you know, go write another movie for me, she did it. And she said, we're going to shoot it in 2 weeks. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure we are. But, you know, yeah, that way it was going to happen. I don't think anything's ever going to happen. I have a hard time knowing what I'm doing in an hour. So the idea that larger things are going to be happening in a month just overwhelmed me with anxiety. So somehow or another, my brain has sought to protect me and just does not deal with anything further ahead than, like, tonight. Which is problematic for people I make plans with, because even if I have to fly somewhere, the night before I'm like, oh, is that tomorrow? I should pack. But improvising my characters. Well, I think that it's not a liability that the nature of what I do both on stage and on the podcast is fairly candid. Yeah. And part of the way I am out in the world is very personal, because there's not much mystique to me if you have gotten to know me through those other two mm-hmm. modes of my expression. So I have to deal with that. You know, like, there's plenty of actors that if you really look at their work, they're kind to themselves most of the time.
Right.
But no one's saying, like, you're just being you, because they don't know them. Most people know me. So they can say that. But the truth is, I don't know in my real life, you know, outside of details that we took from my life in order to set the character mm-hmm. in Alabama. But one of my shortcomings as an actor at this point was I was not even going to attempt an accent. So we had to figure out a way that I got there.
Right.
You know, so there is a lot to me there. There is some of my experience in the character, but I don't think that Mark Maron would resign himself to that type of life, to that type of kind of perpetual heartbreak, to that relationship for as long as he had been in it. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the movie, outside of the sort of fake reality it's set in, is emotionally grounded in that character. And so I think there's a difference there. You know, when you do a character, even if it's in my wheelhouse or it's something that, you know, I can handle as an actor at this point, that the emotional limitations of any one character, I think, will be different, you know, than mine. Even Sam on Glow, you know, people like to say, well, I'm just doing me. No, I mean, Sam Sylvia is not a neurotic person. He's not a self-reflecting person. You know, he's not a guy, at least in the first couple of seasons, that really takes responsibility for his actions. So that's different.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I am doing characters that I can handle, that have my emotional spectrum, you know, can interact with.
Mark Maron is the star of Sword of Trust, which is out in theaters now. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Mark Maron on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mark Maron in studio as we talk about Sword of Trust, which is out in theaters now. You talked right before the break just about Sam on Glow and even this character, Mel. It's amazing to watch the evolution of your career as an actor, because I've known you as a stand-up comedian. I remember Jerusalem Syndrome.
Wow, that's way back.
But that was a one-man show that you were doing in New York City. And to watch how you've turned your stand-up career, which, you know, you had the kind of angry rant style to it, which is cool, but into the evolution of these characters, how do you see it? How do you see how you've evolved as an actor over the last 10 years, decade plus?
Well, I mean, my stand-up early on was, I think that there is definitely not so much a learning curve, but obviously my skill set as a stand-up is pretty dug in. I've been doing it probably almost 30 years, and that's really the core of who I am as somebody who creates things. That is my particular medium of expression. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as time went on and when I did the podcast, you know, which was an act of desperation that turned into sort of a new skill set, that, you know, as I became more comfortable with myself and as the work that I had put in, both in stand-up and a bit on radio, kind of took shape into this new medium that in a format that I had complete control over, mm-hmm. and I do with my producer, Brendan McDonald, a certain element of a lot of, you know, whatever someone's insecure about or whatever their chip on their shoulder is or whatever bitterness they have or self-judgment or comparing yourself to others, you know, it took me a long time to get where I am. So once I started to actually get somewhere and people could realize the expanse of my voice, you know, a lot of those insecurities and anger sort of dissipated. I mean, there's a, you know, low self-esteem can be cured if you know, esteem comes. It doesn't, it's not a chronic condition. If your life changes in a way that, you know, you've worked hard to do something and it starts to pay off, you're like, I feel better about myself because I wasn't wrong about my life, how I chose to spend it. So as time goes on, you know, the opportunity to act came, you know, when I started doing comedy, before alt comedy, before there were, you know, sort of, you know, small rooms that were off the grid, started kind of nurturing anybody and everybody who wanted to do comedy. We were sort of constrained to a, you know, a comedy club universe, but that's sort of how I came up. And at that time when he started, though I was doing stuff to, you know, be provocative and be angry at that time and have a specific voice, so I really didn't make, I had no choice in it. I was always been me. But the point was, is that you were kind of working towards doing a show built around you, which never happened for me. Fortunately, the opportunities I got early on in my comedy career never panned out. I don't think I would have said that if you asked me at that time, but, you know, I wasn't a whole sort of being in terms of how it's, I lived and acted on stage.
I think HBO put out your stand-up special
the half hour.
Like years later. Like
95.
I remember 95, but I remember watching it after, you know, WTF and everything, and watching the difference between, I mean, you're still, it's hilarious, but it was much more political and much more angry. How does that stay with you, or is that something you kind of jettison as you find that voice?
Well, I don't know if it's jettison. Like, you know, I've made specific decisions over the years, but like what I was saying is that, you know, that opportunity to do my own show happened much later in a smaller outlet. I was not, you know, under pressure by networks. I had a certain amount of control when I did Marin on IFC. Mm-hmm. And we were able, you know, I got that opportunity at a time where I could handle it. All the opportunities that I think a lot of my early career in my own early sense of expression was built on spite. Why does that guy get to do that? Why can't I? And thankfully, the opportunity just didn't manifest into anything other than, you know, pilots or pilot scripts.
Because it could have been a different trajectory for your career if you were getting that opportunity when you were feeling that way.
I don't think I could have handled it. I don't think I was ready, really. And someone else knew that, I guess. You know, I'm not going to, you know, say some sort of higher power. I will just put it in the hands of network executives. So what ultimately happened was, I think I'm still intellectually similar, but, you know, I started to integrate life experience and I started to, you know, not have to come out of a place of fear or anger. And I decided early on, you know, not early on, but, you know, not long ago, given that there was such an explosion of stand-ups that, you know, if I didn't run my comedy or my ideas through my direct experience, there was a chance that other people would be doing something similar, you know, because it's not so much hackneyed. It's just, you know, if there's 10,000 comics out there doing comedy and we're all drawing from roughly the same reality or platforms of mediated reality, you know, we're going to come up with similar ideas. So once I started to really move through my own heart and mind around my experience and first person it in a way that placed me at the center of it, you know, not just in ideas, but in experience, I think that it became a more grounded type of approach to politics, you know, drugs, sex, relationships, pop culture, whatever it is that I'm commenting on becomes uniquely mine if I put myself in the middle of it.
You also, when you talk about the word voice, and I think about your voice on WTF and maybe why you have had such tremendous success, obviously great content and being able to cut through the garbage, right?
Yeah, I guess.
But what I love about it is that you were able to be yourself and almost the anti-host in a way. You were able to, and you still are continuing to be able to be, I'm just this guy, I'm interested, I've done the homework, but I'm interested in your life and who you are. And those early episodes, and I think about with other stand-ups that you came up with, that's what resonated, this idea that maybe you weren't putting on a character, that you were yourself, and that's what we became.
That was the reality of it. I'm not sure I got into comedy to entertain people. You know, I think that was sort of backloaded in. I think I had to, you know, I had something to say. I had ideas. I had confidence in them. I decided that stand up was the platform where you could, you know, sort of tell the truth in a way that you had complete control over. I mean, you did have to make people laugh, and I was hit or miss at that for a while, but I was pretty compelling. You know, there was a time where, you know, I really realized that, you know, I'm not everyone's idea of a night out. I mean, you know, so, but ultimately, you know, that worked in my favor because, you know, the audience that does dig me at this point, and I'm a little lighter hearted and a little more, I don't think I've ever been funnier, but, you know, I'm specific and that's good. I'm not trying to entertain everybody.
Like right now, you don't think you've ever been funnier than right now?
No, never. Because
I agree with you. I think every time you come on stage, the audiences perk up. They're very interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, and I think you know, a lot of, you know, over time, my natural timing sort of became better. My comfort level became better. My improvisation skills became better. My freedom of mind on stage. You know, when people talk about character or whatever, I always sort of knew that there were a lot of guys that somehow were able to just become a caricature of themselves on stage. But I think, you know, a liability, but also my strength ultimately was that I think throughout the entire journey of my creativity, I was really struggling to just, you know, land in myself. I think the journey was to complete, you know, and become a whole self. So that's where I ended up. And that's why, you know, the conversations are what they are. You know, I think for the first 100 episodes of WTF, it's just me inviting celebrities over to talk about my problems. And that, you know, sort of evolved into a style of conversation that became the thing, you know. But I'm very wary of people who talk about themselves as brand or being on brand. I don't like the word content. Yeah, I still get nervous and don't really know what I'm going to say to almost every guest that comes into my house. house now. It was my garage before, but the garage that I have in the new house is being worked on. So they're actually in my house upstairs. And I don't think I ever had a character. Now, there is a difference between me on stage and me in a movie or me on a TV show or even me on the podcast. There's another 20 hours of my day that, you know, are not as compelling if you sit there the whole time.
Mark Maron, my guest, Sword of Trust, is in theaters this week. And you can obviously we'll talk about Glow coming up here. Season 3 starts coming up in August. Mark Maron, we'll take a quick break, get an update on tonight's news, come back and continue the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mark Maron in studio, the great podcaster, actor, comedian. Sword of Trust is in theaters now. Great film that just came out and had success at was actually at South by Southwest and now put out in theaters. Glow coming up here, season 3 in August, which is you play the great character Sam. Are we surprised at how successful this show was? I mean, this was at the time when Netflix was putting a lot of stuff out and a lot of stuff coming out. But Glow has become one of the hits of the network.
Given you know what I've gone through to get to where I am, I'm surprised at anything successful. So you know when I never think in terms of I'm not a guy that's sort of like this is gonna kill. This is gonna be great. So anytime that things get attention that I'm involved with, I'm like, really? Well, that's nice. That's good. You know? So I didn't really know. I knew that it was a unique show. I knew that that they were sort of painstakingly kind of detailing that period without it being campy. Mm-hmm. I knew that Sam was a guy I understood. And I knew, all the women were defined in interesting characters. So I knew it was definitely had not been seen before.
Is that important to you as an actor to understand the character?
It's the only way I can do it. I mean, it's like if I read a part or if I'm not really great at reading scripts. I have a hard time picturing things when they're written in scripts. But when I was given the script for the first Glow and the sides, the pages for Sam, you know, right when I read it, I'm like, you know, this is, you know, I can do this guy and I'd like to do this guy. You know, this is a great kind of archetypal character. You know, like the weird thing about Sam being that he's the slightly, you know, kind of misogynist with a heart at the core of a cast of 14 women is how many women come up to me and like, I love Sam. My dad was Sam. My dad had friends who were Sam. Everyone knows a Sam.
The great thing about that character is he's the hero and the anti-hero in the same show.
Yeah, that's I like to think of myself like that in general. It's nice to wear two hats.
When you are deciding what project you're going to do, what's the most important thing? Are you looking to expand or to push and to think of the next character as risk-taking? Or are you looking for comfort? Are you looking for, understanding the character? What are you looking for when you take on your next project?
I don't know. You know, I'm just pretty open. I'm not really looking to take on anything. You know, when I got done with Maron, I was sort of, you know, I ended that show on my own volition. I was like, you know, there's no reason to run this into the ground. It's not like we're making a fortune or they're giving us any more money to make the show better. You know, so what do we got to keep repeating it? So the last season of Maron was a weird journey into drug addiction. That was it. See you later.
See ya.
Had a good time. 4 seasons. And after that, I was like, well, I kind of satisfied that. I did my own show on television. 9 people watched it. But, you know, I did it and it was good. So I wasn't really looking for Glow. And then it just came and I was like, all right. And I read it and I recorded it. You know, I had the guy who works for me sometimes. He recorded it on his phone. I had my trainer, who was an actress, do the Alison Brie's part with me, and we sent the thing in, and I got the part. So, like, things come to me now, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, how much time it's going to take and whether or not, you know, they're trying to hang this small movie on me to sort of as part of the sales package, you know, because then you sort of like, it's going to take 3 months to shoot. It might not go anywhere. I might have to go to a film festival in Arkansas. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's like I'm 55. I don't need to.
It's amazing to think about you as a younger comedian.
Not that I have anything against Arkansas. I don't know much about it, but I probably wouldn't love it.
It's amazing to think about it as a younger comedian, you being the kind of comedian that's like, hey, where's my shot? I want my project. Where's it at? To where you're at now, where you're like, that might take too long. I don't know if I want to do it. That's part of the evolution of an actor as a stand-up comedian.
I guess it's just acting is like, I like acting and I always wanted to do it, but it's a tough job. And I'm glad that my life didn't depend on it, or that was the dream, because it's very hard. You know, I mean, I tried to do some acting when I was a younger comic, and and it's like going out on auditions is horrible. And I didn't have an agent forever. So like anything that happens, you know, what I've seen in my career that has happened to my peers, you know, they go up, they go down, some get huge, and then, you know, something happens, or they just sort of fade away, or they arc out, or, you know, I'm sort of oddly fortunate in that, you know, somehow whatever talent I have, you know, relative to the bitterness that it was capable of, you know, from being disappointed, did not destroy me. You know, drugs didn't destroy me. Bitterness did not, you know, crumble my brain permanently. And somehow, you know, in the second half year, things have changed around. And I didn't expect any of it to happen. By the time, you know, I started the podcast, I sort of really had to let go of most of my dreams, because it was an act of desperation. Things had not worked out. I was, about to go bankrupt in a second divorce. I really couldn't draw an audience. You know, people knew me. I wasn't unknown. But I just never had any real traction. And I had to really sort of say to myself, well, look, man, you know, you can still do comedy, but, you know, there was something about being a kind of like, minor headliner doing B rooms for the rest of my life that really, looked less exciting than dying. There was some moment there where I was just sort of like, all right, well, this stuff isn't going to happen. What can we do with the skill set I have with no expectations?
Do you think there's a lot of comedians that, everything you just described, I think a lot of comedians are going through right now, whether you're in your 30s or 40s, and you're like, okay, where am I at? This is what I'm doing. Do you think a lot of comedians don't have that come-to-Jesus moment you're talking about, where you're like,
hey, man, you know, when you're running your own life and, you know, you get used to a certain thing and there's still this idea that things could happen for you, no matter how bad it gets, I mean, you're sort of at the whims of your own delusion. You know, I mean, it requires a certain amount of delusion to, you know, to even embark on a show and embark on a career in show business. And, yeah. And you know, and it's a hard life, and it's not a meritocracy. And, you know, ultimately, how do you know when you're done? And then there's pride involved in terms of like deciding to exit, especially stand up. You know, guys, you know, great comics have been doing it for 30 years. You know, having to make those kind of decisions is pretty brutal, man.
Yeah.
You know, but it is the life we've chosen. And I think when you're a younger person, you're more idealistic and more ambitious, and you don't think you think it's going to work out. But the odds of it working out are narrow. And as you get older, you realize, you know, by the time I kind of hit the wall, there was no plan B in place. I don't know if there ever was, but, you know, when you get to a certain age and you have those moments where, you know, you've just bottomed out, and then you have that moment where you're like, all right, who cares? I could always, wow, there's nothing in that, there's, what are you going to do? There's nothing there. So, you know, that's a dark moment. Yeah. But I think, you know, it wasn't a matter of faith in my talent or anything other than, you know, persistence and a need to continue to push out there that, you know, it worked out. And I do think that, you know, with the experience, I definitely paid my dues. No one's going to begrudge success, which is a great thing. I'm a rare case of like there's got to be maybe nobody out there going like, that guy doesn't deserve it. You know
how important is that to you, though? How important is the fact that you've had to go through the adversity that you've had to go through in your life to your career today? How important is it?
In my own mind or in general? I mean, clearly it's very important, or it wouldn't have happened. You know, I mean, the thing is that when you get an opportunity and, you know, you take that opportunity, if that first one, that first shot goes well, you know, after that, you better be able to do the job. So, you know, it really comes down to that. You know, you see a lot of people that don't have chops that get big opportunities, and there's a lot of fanfare, and somebody makes a few bucks off of them. But it turns out they don't really have any sort of craft or skill set in place that's going to enable them to keep working at that level. And then, you know, what is that? I hope the winning the lottery thing was good for you, and that you have enough money to live out the rest of your life on that stroke of luck and attention getting, you know.
My final question is for you. You've succeeded in Hollywood at several different levels. Even the podcast world is now a world that Hollywood wants in.
Well, look,
you're the number one guy.
Well, truly, I'm a mid-level celebrity, and I'm not complaining, you know, but I love my audience. I like my fans, but I know where I'm at, you know, and it's a level that I can handle. You know, I'm at the level, I'm not complaining, but I'm really at the level where, you know, if I'm walking down the street and there are three dudes walking towards me the other way, you know, one of them will be like, oh my God, it's Marc Maron. The other two will be like, nah, I don't know that guy. So, like, you know, I'm happy the one guy likes me and knows me, but right. I've learned over time right. that I don't need to stand there while he tries to explain who I am to his friends. That's not a great few minutes. But I, you know, I have success, but it has been defined by me, and I have a, you know, a certain, if not total, control over it, which is a gift. And I'm fairly practical in terms of, like, I'm happy to make a living. I'm not a big spender. I don't need a mansion. You know, I'm not competitive in that way. You know, I'm not greedy. You know, I'm just happy to be making a living, you know, doing what I worked my whole life to do.
The podcast is called WTF with Marc Maron. The film is called Sword of Trust, which is out in theaters now. And Glow, season 3 on Netflix, comes out in August. Marc Maron, thanks so much for coming in studio and talking about your career here on Extension 720.
Nice talking to you, man.